but either ethos or works. Berkeley, I guess, is somewhat the same way.
But that has the excuse of size, or doesn't it?
It's fine, in fact, the members in our office, and Berkeley, the whole name of the game is that you don't spend time in your office, unless it's some research office that nobody knows a number of.
You're afraid of being found by students, or?
Well, I'm sure every faculty member. I was at bargaining sessions, and as a matter of fact, yes, I was at some Council of Ten meetings. It's difficult because after that, I did a stint on the Faculty Senate Committee to advise on bargaining for the contracts, the next version of the contracts. Mm. So I tend to get those meetings mixed up with other meetings.
Yeah.
Of course, any good administrator has to be quite good at forgetting. And
that's what Doremus said.
Well, it's quite true because you have a whole order of the world, which is the way we do things, and then next year you have a certain number of modifications of that. And if you can't forget the way we did things last year, then you're doing things not the way we do them this year. Just discovered this spring that I had been looking at our limited term TA appointments wrong because I had not adequately forgotten the terms of the original contracts as to how, to what the grounds were for making LTE appointments. And so I'd been more nervous about making such appointments than I needed to be according to the current contracts. Similarly, in the process of digging through those files, I discovered that I had been wrong about our arrangements with TAs on office space. Having again remembered what was psychologically more memorable, a long spell of department bargaining right after the first contract was signed on the office space issue, which finally all got wiped out, and having forgotten that although this effort, which took a great deal of time and difficult discussions, came to nothing, we subsequently did make an actual commitment on the subject of office space for TAs as agreement settlements, all done in half an hour by a quick letter, and that didn't stick. As I say, the kind of definite and discreet thing which may get reduced to writing, a written source is going to be a lot better than I'm going to be.
Well,
I don't know what...
In some ways, I'm sure, but in other ways, not. How long have... So you were in the 1971, you were involved in 1971?
Bargaining.
You say you were in the Senate Committee.
Yeah, it must have been, let's see, signed a contract in the spring of 69, that ran for a year.
You mean the spring of 70?
Spring of 70, yeah, I ran for a year, spring of 71, and then started bargaining on new contracts, and that was the round of negotiations on, for which I was on this Faculty Senate Committee to breathe on the bargainers.
I haven't gone into the 71 period yet, so, but
well,
I do want to talk about that. So. Well, but let's begin the interview by your saying when you were born and where and brought up and education.
I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, oddly enough for a UW faculty member, in 1929. And, lived here, went to school here until I went off to college in 1947. And
was your father on the faculty?
No. We knew many faculty people, but he was not. I suppose that's one reason I went east to go to college. I was feeling that I'd already seen this university and wanted to see something else. A decision which my children are now making to my great financial embarrassment. And So then got out of college in 51, worked for 2 years, made a quick try at graduate school for 1 year.
Where did you work?
I worked in for something called the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside of Washington. So for that period, I was a person who actually applied his mathematics. And then, as I say, back to graduate school for a year. Got drafted out of that, 2 years in the Army. Back to graduate school again, this time at Yale, and got out of graduate school in 1960. And came to the University of Wisconsin at that time as an instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And have been here ever since, except for 2 years, which I spent working on a mathematical film project in the mid-60s.
Did you do any teaching at Yale, any TAing at Yale?
Yes, I was a teaching assistant at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, for 2 out of the 4 years I was there.
That's good, so you have something to compare.
Yeah, I think most mathematics faculty members, at least, have been teaching assistants at some stage of their life. So they all have their own notion of what it is to be a teaching assistant, whether or not it's relevant to today's experience.
Yeah.
And in a way, I suppose it's a complicating factor in their relationship to teaching assistants, that they have a personal view of what it means to be a teaching assistant. Want to compare everything with that particular personal view. Gives them some insights which are useful and some other insights which are confusing.
I'm trying to think whether that would be true of most departments, that they would have necessarily been TAs, had some teaching experience as graduate students. Would that be particularly true of math and languages?
Well, I'm sure it's more likely to be true of mathematics and languages, since by tradition those departments, since those departments have a great need for instruction at a relatively elementary level, and that has led to a tradition of heavy use of teaching assistants, so that, certainly in departments such as biochemistry here, there is a much higher ratio of research support to teaching support for graduate students, and I've never done any statistical surveys on these things, but what is true here very often turns out to be typical of what's true over the country, so it might be that biochemists tend not to have had TA experience.
So what would you like to comment about the math department? Describe it, what it was like when you came here, and in terms of size and divisions among faculty members and directions it was going in.
Well, let's see, it was just entering on a period of rapid expansion. There had been a time in the recent past when the whole departments could have gone down to Crick Commons and sat around a single table and settled all their business over lunch without having to make special reservations for this purpose.
I counted the number of math faculty in 1958, and I think it was 17, not even that high, I think.
That's, yes.
And now it's 75, I think.
From 65 to 85, depending on what version of counting you use, the minimal counting being the number of people who were actually payroll for teaching purposes in a given semester. That would be typically about 65 now, and 85 being the total number of people on our books, including mm-hmm. people on leave, research support, other
things.
Charing,
yeah.
Yeah. And, or part-time people. The department at that time, I suppose, may have been about 30, that time being 1960. And
incidentally, what is your field? What are your interest in math?
Back in the days when I could be said to have a mathematical field, it was functional analysis, or sometimes called soft analysis. do. I don't imagine any people who consult these tapes are going to either recognize those words or really want to take lecture on what they mean.
Tell me, was it a new, is it something new in math, or is it one of the...
Well, it is something that began to emerge as a particular subspecialization in mathematics, say right around the turn of the century. One can, and in fact, that is a retrospective recognition that what these people were doing at the time was going to lead to something called functional analysis. The decision that it had led to a separate sub area would have taken place around 1930 or thereabouts. So it is a relatively new area as mathematical areas go, but not the very newest. It's not, certainly at that time, was not an area which was terribly well represented in the mathematics department.
Okay, go on.
So, let's see, the department was growing rapidly. It was changing its viewpoint of itself somewhat. Moving from a situation in which people really thought in terms of face-to-face dealings, one-on-one dealings, thinking in terms of group dealings.
With undergraduate students?
With one another. I really intended that to apply to dealings with their colleagues. So that...
You were ceasing to talk to each other.
No. It was becoming the more of an era in which, if you wanted to talk about a matter of departmental interest, you would actually have a meeting for that purpose and do the talking at the meeting, as opposed to somebody dropping into somebody else's office and saying, I've talked to X and he says this, and now I'm talking to you. After I find what you say, I'll talk to Z, and then it will be done. I think, must have been the way things got done predominantly during the 50s. And we were just in a period of transition. I think it was probably around this time that we must have started hiring new faculty much more by collecting applications and having a committee look through the applications, and much less by having somebody call up a friend and say, have you got a good person for us this year? I can't positively assert that, because of course that sort of hiring decision is not one in which instructors, such as I then was, participates. But I have that feeling from people who were involved in such decisions at the time.
And this was to handle the increasing enrollment at that time? It was the beginning growth in the department?
Yeah, enrollments were increasing then, and of course the country's belief in the necessity of college education was increasing at that time.
And
this
what
was
about
already the so-called post-Sputnik era. So it was possible to turn those increasing enrollments into increased funding. It was possible even to get funding which wasn't based strictly on enrollments. The federal government was coming into research support heavily during that period. And people were looking ahead to the enrollment increases which occurred during the 50s. It was, I think, understood that a university or a department such as this one would be heavily involved in training the math faculty who would go and teach these enrollments, these increased undergraduate enrollments, not only on this campus but on other campuses. And indeed, during the decade of the 60s, faculty members here spent at least half of their instructional time on producing PhDs who would be undergraduate teachers mostly elsewhere, and only half their time on teaching undergraduates here. And this, of course, was true. It's, I think, all the major state universities, all the ones who were running high-quality graduate programs, and it made the whole impact of the demographic ups and downs much more severe, because faculties were expanded at that time to not only meet the undergraduate needs of the institution, but to train graduate students to teach elsewhere. And then around 1970, when the demography changed, you had a productive capacity for, which included the capacity to produce PhDs at a rate no longer needed, and some of that capacity was diverted back to producing undergraduate students, thereby cutting the needs for new PhDs even more than would have been the case if there'd been a fixed ratio of faculty to undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
We managed to more or less make that transition without really unpleasant things happening, but it has made a very difficult, it's made very significant difficulties for mathematicians getting doctorates in the 70s.
Although I gather there were fewer wanting to get doctorates for that matter.
Yeah. Of course, it takes a while for the word to get back. As a matter of fact, I think that even on the day I came here, everything I just said must have been more or less visible. Well, no, that's not true. The decline in birth rates was not clearly established at that time. But let's say by 1966, all these things would have been reasonably visible to a person who had no other purpose in mind but to form a correct prediction of the future.
Yeah.
But, of course, none of the people involved were in that situation. They all had special interests to pursue. And where all predicting, of course, involves a certain degree of uncertainty, and if you have a strong special interest to pursue, your uncertainties may get resolved in a systematic way, so that what was going to happen in 1970 was not terribly well appreciated by mathematics faculty in 1966. And it takes a further amount of time for realizations to percolate from faculty to students. It takes about 5 years for a successful student to get a PhD in this university, so there's an additional lag time there. You get students who came in a year in which everybody said there's a great future. A year later, people realize the future is not so great, but here the student has got a year invested in a PhD program and probably will continue. So it's certainly students nowadays, that is people, I say, kind of students I'm thinking of at the moment are potential graduate students, people who are now seniors, do understand that there is not a sort of escalator which will carry them right through a graduate program and into a faculty sort of job.
Mm-hmm.
1970, I don't think that was appreciated by first-year students.
Something you said, it interested me, though I may have picked it up wrong, that in the 60s you were concerned, you were aiming to train teachers for other undergraduate institutions. Did you think of yourself as training teachers or just getting graduate students to do research?
The department thought of itself as training researchers, which may be just slightly different from what you proposed.
You used the word.
It's certainly different from what
teachers.
I said. What I said, of course, reflects the point of view of the people who were going to sign the salary checks of all these people we were training. They were thinking in terms terms of hiring undergraduate teachers, but what we considered that we were training was future mathematics
yeah, that's
researchers.
What I would have assumed. I didn't see.
On the other hand, in mathematics, there is relatively little connection between a graduate student's research and his major professor's research. That is to say, he will almost certainly be doing research in an area in which his major professor is also doing research, but it is less likely that he's going to be a really integral part of his major professor's research plan. In contrast,
his major professor isn't using him to do a section of his own research.
Right. In the lab sciences, you have these very elaborate experiments which require a very large team effort. It is often the case that the student comes in and becomes a part of that team without the problem, the experiment has already been set up. He's not involved in that. The significance of the work is not necessarily going to depend on, is not going to be evident from his particular end of it. He is going into this cooperative sort of setting, or you know, you can call it a factory setting. That is his training for, that's his dissertation work. In mathematics, it is not so. The student is likely to wind up working on a problem in the area of interest to his major professor, a problem which the major professor is interested in knowing the answer to a question. But it's not going to be essential, typically, to the major professor's research that the answer to that particular question gets generated.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. So that's how students are related to major professors in
yeah.
mathematics.
Do you want to say anything more about the department? I was wondering if the Math Research Center started in the middle of, no, in 55 it started, hadn't it?
Sometime
it was already
in the 50s,
underway.
Right.
Was in the 60s, was this already a divisive issue in the department?
Though not in the early 60s, in any. The questions about the Math Research Center were totally unrelated, except through the medium of individuals' psychologies, to the questions that came up later. In the early 60s, the questions, as seen by the math department people, were how this related to applied mathematics and to the support of applied mathematics. Would we come to regret having a sort of a second math department here? Would that be so successful that it ate up the existing math departments?
Did you have anything to do with the Army Math Research Center? I mean, were you working for them?
No, I was never supported by them or involved with them. And indeed, much of what I'm saying about feelings during this period can't be regarded as really authoritative, because the people who are considering the matter most thoroughly and who are most involved with it were the more senior faculty. They were the ones who were worried about what is the future of the math departments. At that time, I wasn't. I suppose I paid for that since. Now I have practically nothing to do but worry about the math department as an institution. But that was one of the generational differences which were very much on everybody's minds in the early 60s, that previous generation of mathematicians really had been brought up to give quite a good deal of consideration to institutional considerations as opposed to disciplinary considerations. And I suppose, although I don't really know, that that simply grew out of the hard times when you had better think about your institution because you were very lucky to have one. At any event, people did think of the older generation about not just mathematics, but the math department at the University of Wisconsin.
People like Mark Ingram.
He certainly had this point of view very strongly. Of course, he was at that time a dean, and deans must think institutionally. Whereas the people who were getting PhDs at that time thought very much in disciplinary terms, what about mathematics? And I can do mathematics at this place or that place or the other place, as indeed was the case at the time. I can go to the federal government and quite likely get a research grant, which is, although it's made to an institution, is, as far as the financial and legal ends go, is not awarded primarily because the institution's name appears on the grants, but because of whatever I put in the narrative about whatever people think of me as a person. So that recent PhDs during the first half of the 60s in particular had very much this point of view, and they created a bit of generational tension.
It didn't matter where they worked, as far as they were concerned, as long as the circumstances and the pay and the time.
Yeah, and the idea of let us deny ourselves this or that here because it would be good for our department in the long run seems reasonably credible to the more senior people and seems just very strange to the younger people at that time.
Has that come back now? To digress a bit?
Yeah, well, of course, it's difficult for me to give an immediate answer to that question because at that time I was on the bottom end of this whole operation, and people on the bottom end are usually more acutely conscious of generational differences, et cetera, than people on the top end. People
so
on the bottom end are always
really
biting their tongue to avoid these issues coming out at an inopportune time. They know they're biting their tongue, and if they're successful in biting their tongue, the people on top don't really notice. It's not clear to me that, let's see, the people who've come here now as new PhDs get a letter that says, this is a typically a two-year job, and that's it. And that's exactly the way it is. And my perception is that we don't therefore ask more than a very minimal amount of institutional sacrifice out of these people, because the deal is explicitly that this institution is not their not even potentially their home for the long run. We do get, we do ask that they do their instruction well, and one of the very nice things that's happened since 1970 is that PhDs since that time are much more concerned with undergraduate teaching than they were in 1960. They just have it much more at heart.
This is because, evidently, of the TA strike.
No, I'm thinking of 1970 as the start of a new decade. These people that I'm talking about, these are new PhDs that I've observed as they arrived in Madison, and therefore people that weren't here for the TA strike. I think it's may in parts come out of the whole second half of the 60s, where everybody under 30 was saying that universities have turned their back on teaching, and et cetera, et cetera, and all these people that we're seeing as PhDs now were in universities at some point in their career during that period and may have taken it to heart and done something about it, so, which is the delightful part. And of course, also, ones getting PhDs now realize that there is not going to be an infinite expansion in research supports. You know, in 1960, it was possible to, if you allowed your fantasy a little bit of free play, to suppose that by 1970, everybody would be 100% research and 0% teaching. Yeah, nobody could have believed that if they'd sat down and thought about it carefully. But people usually don't behave entirely on the basis of sitting down and thinking about things carefully, but on the basis of rather sloppy perceptions. So that was the climate 1960.
Yeah.
The climate 1970 says teaching is going to be very important to you for all your, if you're lucky enough to get an academic job, it's going to be important right along. And as I say, this is showing up in the skill and conscientiousness and all those other things as regards teaching that our new PhDs are bringing to us.
Well, again, this is jumping ahead of a question I intended to ask at the end, but are you rewarding these people because they're teaching for good teaching?
No, because these are the people that are here for 2 years and going somewhere else. We aren't,
well, let's say in terms of a recommendation, it's against the research that I assume they're doing also. All right, let's leave that out.
Okay.
That would be something I have.
Right, why don't you
ask it about the faculty
later
in general? Yeah. Well, what about the reason I asked about the Math Research Center was whether it was creating a political division and political
climate. That's right. We wandered off that.
The TA
certainly
might have fit it into.
I don't think during the first half of the 60s that there were any relationship between Math Research Center questions and TA questions. So I say there was concern about a second autonomous entity doing mathematics on its campus and what that might mean in terms of competition for all the good things of life. There was also the fact that the department had a somewhat unfocused feeling that it should be doing something about applied math, and they could never get it quite straight in its mind whether that was to be done through Math Research Center or in cooperation with Math Research Center or in competition with Math Research Center. And I don't have the details of that at all, but there seems to have been a lot of false starts and people coming here thinking they were going to do this or that and deciding that this or that was unfeasible as regards applied math during the first half of the 60s. And I strongly suspect hurt feelings and the like, but these were only slightly visible to a non-tenured faculty person, and I suspect that even some of the things that I now think of, as manifestations of this sort of tension, I don't think I recognized as manifestations of that tension at the time, but then as I've gotten older, looked at department records, thought about why so-and-so left in such-and-such a year, now can see a bit more of those, or identify a bit more of these things as having sprung out of that.
It sounds like something that's worth looking into perceptively.
Well, if you wanted to write a history of the math departments, it would be a very interesting question. As I say, during the first half of the 60s, it had nothing to, that I can identify as having to do with TAs. The only possible connection being that if we arbitrarily say 1965 is a change of an era, why you go into a new phase, why at that time there were people around who were looking unhappily at MRC, and once you're unhappy with an institution for one reason, you find it's easier to be unhappy with it for another reason.
Yeah.
But somewhere, I wasn't here in 65. The years I did this film project were 64 to 66. They must have been watershed years at the University of Wisconsin. I was out in San Francisco looking at the free speech movements, and
You mean by chance, looking at them?
Yeah, I was living in Berkeley. Yeah. I was not connected with the University of California, but I was nonetheless living there, and there it was in the newspapers every day. And like people who left the old country everywhere, I was thinking all these changes could never take place back in Wisconsin. It's all something funny that has to do with California. And I had a whole theory about polarization and so on. And came back to discover that very minor versions of the same thing had been going on here, and that indeed we were about to see much larger versions of them going on here, perhaps just a couple of years behind California. It was really where we were at.
Incidentally, why don't you say what, I know the title of your research had something, one-to-one relationships in the elementary school teachers. How?
Let's see, what I was doing out in California.
Didn't you do a film?
I did a film called One-to-One Correspondence. Was part of a film package for future elementary school teachers.
Does this mean you were interested in elementary school teaching, or had
no,
nothing really to do with
it? When I went out there, nothing was really from my mind.
I don't really want to talk about that, but it's just something that we put here. And
I was interested
wants to look
in the
it up,
whole idea of trying to do films about mathematics. And,
about teaching mathematics?
The frank answer is I went out there being interested in doing films about mathematics. Mm-hmm. The overt purpose of these things, of course, was to teach people. I certainly didn't go out there with a point of view. I imagined a group of students. I want this group of students to be different at the end of some program than they were at the beginning. I can see that film is the right way to do this. In fact, the rationale which people had for this program at the time was initially not so much that there are certain kinds of teaching which can be better done on film, but rather that we have a terrible shortage of teachers and it will be necessary to use such labor-extending devices as films to meet the
shortage.
So you
were revealing something about mathematics in the film. Shown on a film than in a book.
Well, of course, you know, the next stage in sophistication is to say, what can film do better than other methods of presentation? And that's about where we got at that stage in the project. That particular project was significant to me in that it did make me think more about teaching questions. You had to get into that. You had to decide, indeed, if you're going to make a film somewhere in mathematics, where will you make it? And then you get on to this question, what is appropriate for film? And then you get on to questions, how do people learn anyway? And you discover that nobody has much of a notion to the answer. And then if you continue, at least if you're me, you finally discover that most of what people think they know is just something they made up. Rationalize what they're already doing. That's another story again.
When did you get on tenure here?
When I came back from this film project. I don't even remember whether I came back to a job with tenure or whether I came back with the understanding that I would get tenure after 1 year's worth of conscientious work. It certainly was the understanding that tenure would be attached to this job if I didn't totally mess it up. I've now forgotten.
Attached to this job, you...
This job that I'm now doing, which
is
the associate
chairman. Oh, you came back as associate chairman?
Right.
Oh, I see. Right. Not and had you stopped teaching then, or were you?
Well, I've never entirely stopped teaching as associate chairman. I teach one course a semester, and other guys in the department typically teach two courses a semester.
Yes, not much of a difference. Is it what? Is it an undergraduate or graduate course?
That I teach since I've been associate chairman, I've been teaching undergraduate courses. And, people which are teaching graduate courses really ought to be at least potentially directing doctoral dissertations, and that is not a realistic thing for me to be trying to do. And so it wouldn't make sense for me to be trying
to. So you must have worked with TAs then?
In my own teaching, no. Or at least the correct answer is very, very minimally. I was involved with a TA a couple of times, but the way a standard faculty member becomes involved with a teaching assistant is that the faculty member gives the lectures in a lecture discussion course, and he has a bunch of TAs who give the discussions. And I didn't want to be giving lectures in a lecture discussion course, and when...
Because you disapproved of the method.
No. I just disapprove of it for me. I approve of the lecture discussion method for instance, first semester calculus, but I don't particularly like doing the lectures myself. It's also the case that when I first came here, I got simply assigned to be the lecturer in a bunch of lecture discussion courses. I'd never done that before, and didn't know how to do it, wasn't very happy doing it, and the guy who was running the courses at the time was not a man who inspires the people he's dealing with through generating warm personal feelings. In fact, he was a tough cookie.
Who was that?
I'm not sure that's relevant. He's not here anymore. I found it a rather traumatic experience, and certainly I found that I was being leaned on as a faculty member much more strongly than I had been leaned on as a teaching assistant. Mm. Called to account much more as a faculty member than I had as a teaching assistant.
Was he doing the lectures and you were doing the discussions, or were you doing lectures?
No, I was doing the lectures, but he was
directing a whole set of courses.
Lectures, right. In fact, he'd been involved in developing a version of first-year calculus which was taught in the lecture discussion format. Prior to that time, my impression is that all instruction had been in small sections, and it must have been something as simple as that for calculus and above, the faculty took the small sections, and for courses preceding calculus, the TAs took the small sections. Mm. But then, in response to the great increases in enrollments, the department was looking for ways to involve TAs in a broader spectrum of teaching. It was unwilling, or at least it's my inference that it was unwilling to, I don't actually know. Whether it was unwilling to entrust TAs with the sole responsibility for courses at the level of calculus, or whether it wished to make sure the faculty remained involved with courses at the level of calculus, or I suppose a more likely possibility is it had a mixture of those motives. But at any event, how do you respond to that? So you create a lecture discussion format and let the faculty and the TAs share the teaching in those courses.
Yeah, did this go? This went on for quite a while, or does it still? I've heard some criticism of the way, the method of teaching calculus.
Right. At that time, we were offering two versions of calculus. One was given in the lecture discussion format, one was given in the small class formats. And around 1965 or thereabouts, the small course format was phased out, except for honors courses, and from 65 till last year or so, except for honors sections, all calculus was in elective discussion formats. And now, within the last year or two, we have taken a, well, let's see. In the interim, we have created yet an additional version of calculus. Since I've gone this far, I will say that when I came here, we had the so-called Math 20 series, which was viewed as being calculus for math majors, physics majors, perhaps chemistry majors, and the like. We had, and that was taught in small sections. We had the Math 60 series, which was calculus for engineers and people like engineers, taught lecture discussion. Then around the mid-60s, we renumbered all courses, and shortly thereafterwards, the courses which had derived from the Math 20 series ceased to be given, and the courses which derived from the Math 60 series were modified slightly, became the Math 221, 23 series, which is now considered calculus for math students, engineering students, and natural science students. And in the latter part of the 60s, we created yet another version of the calculus, which was considered to be slanted towards the biological and social sciences. And when that was created, it was created in a lecture discussion formats, but just recently we have moved that back to small sections taught by faculty. Again, responding to economics or demography, really. At this stage, our need is to have more faculty and fewer TAs, and this is a way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, so there hasn't been essentially any criticism of the, if this is a method of teaching calculus,
lecture
but just that you're
sure. All kinds of criticism of this as a, method of discussion, a method of teaching. It's, you know, it's the inception. There were a lot of people who said they bloody well, a lot of faculty said they bloody well didn't want to give large lectures, that they didn't feel that this gave them any sort of contact with students, which they felt was important to their teaching.
Were they saying this in the 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were saying, as a matter of fact, not just that they didn't want to do this, but that it, that is, have classes without personal involvement with the students, but that it was for everybody a bad idea to have classes in which this sort of, in which the faculty member didn't get this sort of personal contact with the students. And the answer to that was, well, it may be bad for you, but it's not bad for everybody. We won't ask you to be a lecturer in these courses, so let that be an answer. And, in fact, that point of view prevailed. And so there, these kind of guys, this group of people still occasionally stirs around and says, you know, we really ought to get back to the proper mode of teaching in which all classes are small. But they don't have quite the enthusiasm for pushing that as a departmental policy that they did in the 60s, because after all, they've lived decades in which it hasn't been departmental policy.
But, do they tend to be the more liberal wing of the department? I mean, politically liberal, that might be your sort of person or not?
There probably is a significant correlation, but there's not a nice clear line.
Do you know much about how TAs were appointed and supervised? Did it vary from person to person, faculty member to faculty member? Was there much discussion of it in faculty meetings in the 60s? As there was increasing use of TAs?
Not a great deal. Let's see, how they were, how we use a management word, how they were supervised. The course is given on a lecture discussion system. The running of the TAs is left almost entirely up to the lecturer. Each, in a course such as Math 221, there may be 6 lecturers working at a given semester, and each of them will have a group of TAs, and the details of what the TAs do in that course are pretty much up to that lecturer.
And nobody else paid any attention.
Right. And I think this was, I have no reason to doubt that this was the case right along. Courses in
Did it ever occur to anybody that somebody might look into how the TAs were being handled and whether they were being properly trained? And
oh, yeah. Sure. And I should say that this, what I've just said about the lectures, making their own arrangements with TAs, is a statement which is true in a pretty well understood and accepted context of what TAs do and don't do. If a lecturer were to say that basically he's quitting lectures and going to have all his TAs run the courses as though they were small discussions on the one hand, or that he's wants his house painted and he's going to have all his TAs come out and paint his house on the other hand, then he would bump up against a solid wall somewhere and be told.
Where would the wall be? You mean somebody would know about it?
Some of the TAs would say, but good heavens, that is not the way things are done at the University of Wisconsin. Certainly in the house painting instance. And possibly even in the cutting the TAs loose instance. And then the word would get back to department types like me, and the lecturer would have one of those little mutual exploration sessions with the department administration.
Oh, so you were pretty much aware of what individual faculty members, how they were working with their TAs at that time.
Well, let's see.
I'm thinking of the Mulvihill report. Is in the back of my mind, and the recommendations they made, the situation they found, and the recommendations they made, and how this applied to the math department.
The Google Mulvihill reports. That's something I'm a bad source on. The fellow who's more or less in charge of TAs in the math department time, Dick Askey, was on the Mulvihill committee.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize he was in the math department. That's interesting.
Yeah. Askey was.
Yeah, I see.
Right. And I kept asking him what's going on. Let's see, that report.
68. 68.
Well, I was associate chairman, right. So I was interested at that time. As to what that report might look like when it came out. And I was trying to find out from asking. He was saying, oh no, we're all sworn to secrecy. So I wrote it down in my head, the Mulvihill report is a bloody mystery, and I think when it came out, I never corrected that impression.
Oh, why?
Sheer stupidity. Plus, when it came out, I don't think it was a very earth-shaking document. Any respect, and you know, I must have had enough interest to know whether it's very much like what I was saying about these lectures. I somehow satisfied myself it lay within some set of prior understandings, and said, okay, you know, it's in that set. No more needs to be said about it.
You mean you felt that on the whole you were doing the things that they were already recommending? Is that what you mean?
Right. And if you now ask me what they recommended, I don't know, and but I certainly had at the time a few.
Well, stipulating reasons for appointment and some degree of training. For instance,
right.
did anybody, they suggested giving, it suggested giving a 1-credit course in teaching. Was this done? I don't think the TAs would have liked it very much, but here.
Well, faculty in the math department one of the things that is constants from the beginning of our story in 1960 until today is that the faculty in the math department would not wish to offer a credit course in teaching the TAs. And the reasons which should be cited would be that this is not enough of our area of expertise that we should offer credits in such a course, and that there, how to teach is not something that can be taught in a course, and graduate students are supposed to pick this up on their own or construct it for themselves and not take time out of their formal studies to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
That, as I say, is an invariant right up and down the line. Let's see, if I can try to tie up a few of the loose ends in the last few minutes. Sort of detailed supervision of TAs and lecture discussion courses is done by the lecturer, and so far as I know, that was the case even at the beginning of our story. There are other courses in which TAs are the sole classroom instructors, and for each of those courses there is a TA supervisor, well, he's called a course supervisor, or she, as the case may be.
This was also in before the TA strike, was it?
This was the case before the TA strike. It was the case in 66 when I began to pay attention to these things, and I think it was the case earlier on. You know, when I came here, I didn't know there was a course Math 101, let alone who taught it or what the arrangements were. I think the same situation is probably true for the majority of the people who came here as fresh assistant professors or instructors or lecturers, whatever, last fall. Perhaps they were more attuned to questions of teaching, but not enough so to want to know all the different varieties of pre-calculus courses we give and how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we also had a committee which made the TA appointments at that time, and at that time this was a committee which had a lot of real work to do, because every TA appointment was a real decision. Since the contract TAs, there are a large number of appointments which don't represent a real decision. The TA gets a reappointment, he's on a guarantee of 3 or 4 years, and he gets reappointed unless he's done something striking.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot less work involved now than there was at that time.
Was there enough outside money coming in terms of grants for research, fellowships, that sort of thing, so that TAs in the math department, or graduate students in the math department, didn't long to get a TA-ship as they did in some other departments?
It was always the case throughout this entire decade of the 60s that the majority of all graduate student support in this department was through teaching assistantships.
Oh, yes.
And even in the heyday of federal supports, I doubt whether as many as half of our successful PhDs would ever have had research support, research assistantship or something during their whole stay here.
Mm.
Perhaps it got up to something like half. Mm. We'd get at least 1 year of research assistantship, but of course it takes people about 5 years here to get a PhD. So
most of them were TAs at one time or another.
Yeah, essentially. Let's see, there'd be a very small class of people during the 60s who would have gone through here on fellowship, which they would have gotten from Washington, NSF fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't have really looked to the department for that kind of support at all. Anybody else, any other graduate student, would certainly have been at TA for at least 1 year, probably for more years than not.
Do you think, was the department ever recruiting graduate students by offering them TA-ships, as some departments, I understand.
We certainly are extremely conscious of the fact that graduate students have to somehow get supported. In particular, they don't look to their parents to send them to graduate school. Somehow there has to be money if they're to be graduate students. And
but I mean hiring them the first year and then dropping them as TAs.
No, we never had a policy of trying to concentrate all our teaching assistantships on first year students.
Mm-hmm.
At least, yeah. I can say that very definitely since 1966, when I really had to pay attention to these things, and I've never seen any suggestion in reviewing the prior years that we had anything like that policy before. Indeed, in 66, when I got here, the what we felt we were doing was supporting people who made good academic progress for a period which we calculated to be reasonably enough to get a PhD, let's say 5 years. And indeed, we didn't have a statement that a TA after 5 years is only going to be a rare sort of exception. We did have a feeling that after 5 years, we would not welcome making a TA, would not be happy to make a TA appointment unless we had a statement from the major professor, really this guy's going to get done this next year. But we had always viewed it as a system which, at least statistically, would provide support for a total graduate career, or at least a total successful graduate career. Now, of course, the TAs, our own TAs, were less certain on that point than we were. I don't think they can ever have thought that in the math departments, TAs were systematically used to bring students here and then turn them loose and drop them from departmental support.
Mm-hmm.
They may have felt that we did more of this than we should have, something like that, but they can't have felt that that was, you know, a nice, simple, and fair description of our policies. Even I don't think even Hank Aslack would have thought such a thing.
When did you, does that finish up the loose ends?
If there, I have a feeling it doesn't, but I don't remember what the other loose ends were. I guess I wanted to try and sort of define the different types of people who were involved fairly heavily with teaching assistants during the 60s. And so, yeah, you'd ask questions, do people think about teaching assistants and what their conditions of employment ought to be, and were people thinking about that during the 60s? And the answer is certainly the, you know, what I've said indicates that there are some people in the department who are fairly heavily involved with teaching assistants, and there are other people who don't fit any of the categories I enumerated who weren't involved with teaching assistants, save for something implicit in what I've also said, namely that most all graduate students were teaching assistants, and that most all faculty members are involved with graduate students as PhD students or potential PhD students, and so they were in that sense involved
A meets C
with teaching assistants, but they weren't involved with them in anything like an employer-employee relationship or in anything like a shared instructional responsibility relationship. They were employed with that student's TA's work in the same way that student's wife might be involved with the student's TA work. The TA would say, you know, guess what happened to me as a TA today?
Was class size all right here? Did they have two? Did you feel they were being overworked or having too many students?
No. Neither I individually nor the department as a whole. Before the contracts, we had a very significant disparity in the size of classes, depending on what size of TA classes, depending on what course was involved, which turned out to be a fortunate thing for us. And the class size limit TAs and pre-calculus courses would, at least when this rationale was constructed, have been seeing students 4 days a week, and therefore could, you know, get to know a considerably larger group of students.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, this meant that when the limit went in as 19 across the board, we were able to raise class sizes in the calculus as well as lower class sizes in the pre-calculus courses, and weren't in the budget crunch that other departments were, at least to nowhere near the same extent. So that had been done. In the mid-60s, the then chairman, Creighton Buck, he was the chairman while I was away, 64 to 66, and I think he was the, that was a watershed period, and he was the department chairman who first said, look, we have to do considerable reshaping of the department to reflect the fact that 1965 is different from 1955. To actually have that as a principle, as I think his predecessors may have made this or that concession to changing times, but didn't really change their overall framework of thinking. So one of his projects was indeed to try to involve teaching assistants more in their work as teaching assistants. And, he inspired a couple of them, for instance, to prepare a handbook for teaching assistants. And this was a reasonably, it was quite a good job, really. And indeed, we are still using a descendant of that handbook.
This is for the math department TA.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to do something about getting orientation periods set up for teaching assistants. We had orientation periods.
How did they work? I mean, how well did they work?
Well, the whole thing fluctuates, has fluctuated. Some years we've had orientations which were ambitious and successful, and other years we've had orientations which were only moderately ambitious, and in some cases not very successful. That is, we told TAs a lot of stuff they didn't need to know, and we knew it, and they knew it. And in other years we've had very minimal orientation sessions, which, you know, more or less were getting across a few basic points about who you report to and where your office is. And then
does this depend on who's running it?
Mm-hmm. Oh. It depends entirely on whether the people involved in that year are both competent and enthusiastic, or whether they just see it as something to get through as rapidly as possible. At that time, the emphasis was very much on the junior colleague point of view, that these people are just ourselves, these TAs are just ourselves, set back a certain number of years in time. They should be encouraged to take responsibility, to involve themselves in their work, made to feel important parts of our staff, and all like that there. And that point of view got stretched thin, of course, during the latter 60s, and was a, you know, total casualty of the TA strike.
Got stretched thin because of the increasing militancy of the TAs.
Yeah, so general.
When did you become aware that there was, you yourself, I guess, that there was going to be a problem with TAs?
About the day that Ed Young recognized TAA.
Did you think that was a wise thing to do or not?
Yeah, I've always thought that was a may go down as Well, of course, it's hard to judge. I mean, these whole TA union may really come to nothing, and people won't care much about that decision. If it doesn't come to nothing, then I think people may remember that as one of the really clever things that Ed Young did. He took a hell of a beating with a substantial segment of his faculty for having done so, and I suspect with other constituencies at the university as well. But I think the alternative, if he'd gone for dilatory tactics and trying to stall him, would have been much worse. And I think that if he had tried to consult his faculty at the time, you know, my perception, at least, he didn't consult his faculty. As he may have, you know, called 10 or 50 people into his office and talked about it, but a typical faculty member had no feeling at all of having been consulted. This was a bolt from the blue. But if he had tried to involve faculty in general, then I'm sure it would have become a polarizing issue, which dragged on for years and years and years in the worst sort of debates all around the campus. Things would have been a great deal worse. Now, of course, in retrospect, one could say that there was TA militancy before that period, but at the time, you see, we were involved in all kinds of tensions about the war in Vietnam and student power and all the rest, and which were, of course, all major impetuses to TAA, but we're now breaking off a piece of it and calling it the TAA piece, and at the time that was a much less reasonable thing to do than it is now. Even now, you know, it's maybe an artifact, but at the time it was by no means clear. But I think our attitude towards TAs as TAs at the time the union was recognized, we were placed on notice that we might have to look at it, and certainly by, let's see, that was spring of 69. Well, certainly, that would be just about the moment. It all happened then with incredible rapidity.
Yeah.
By spring of 70, we were in a strike.
Did the MAF, the TAA members, when did they start, or did they start coming to faculty meetings and making themselves heard?
I suppose it was during that year, 68-69, that we began getting questions of this sort. I've forgotten when the, I don't know what it's called, Afro-American Studies demonstrations or Black Students demonstrations were. That was generated some desires, or that focused some desires for stuff like student participation in department meetings. And yeah, of course, to me, the first sign of all this was a Dow demonstration, which took place, you know, essentially right under our noses.
Yeah.
And also a number of our TAs were involved, and that, you know, was a shocking confrontation to everybody. It was a major shock. Then the Black students, another major shock. And then those each had much more impact on a typical faculty member in this department, actually, than this TAA recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after the TA recognition, we then started hearing from TAs that we really, really mean it, and that wasn't an event which happened all in one day or all in one week, as these others had, but its total cumulative effect over the following year was, of course, much greater, because this really had to do with us where we lived, whereas these other things we could distance ourselves from.
When were you first aware of the kind of hostility that the TAA bargainers were going to be expressing towards the faculty and the administration? Were you prepared for it from your contacts with TAs?
No, I don't. suppose that I had really given much thought to that question. We had not been dealing with determined and or hostile TA delegations or anything like that at all. There had been no organized activity by TAs visible to the department administration.
Because there were many TAs from the math department who were, I think, who were active in the top levels of the TAA, besides Hank Haslack, who's the obvious case.
Yeah, he's a really obvious case. And he, of course, is always one who has been less concerned to be ameliorative, even in this department, than other TAs. During that whole period, I guess it's been a common strand in TAs' statements to faculty from the beginning through the end that the existence of TAA should not be viewed as something hostile to at least the faculty in the particular department the TAs are talking to at the time. Our TAs were telling us throughout this period that actually if other departments were all like mathematics, perhaps there wouldn't be a need for a TAA, but...
That's interesting.
I think
the French department felt that way too.
Sure. It was only people who were involved in something like bargaining who had a chance to talk to their colleagues in other departments and discovered that if you put together all the departments where things were okay, in that particular department, you had, in fact, all the departments where there were TAs. This statement was being made in essentially each department. Therefore, it's...
Even in the history department?
I'm sure there were people, even in the history department, who were told by their TAs that actually the problems weren't in the history department, but somewhere else.
I see.
When a TA is in talking to his major professor, who may within a matter of months say that is a thesis or isn't a thesis, the TA has a strong incentive to stress the positive, not the negative. And of course, as a group, TAA could hardly hope to exist if it had the determined opposition of the faculty, united opposition of the faculty. That would be the end of them. I guess getting back to your question, I guess never would have supposed that bargaining sessions involving, say, Haslack would be ones in which people would be slapping one another on the back and proceeding from an air of camaraderie. I didn't have any presuppositions about bargaining, and I suppose I forget the exact sequence of events. I don't suppose I was at the very first bargaining session there ever was. I may well have heard from somebody who'd been there, boy, these are bad news. Somewhere along that time I got to go to one. Indeed, it was I don't have a recollection of going to a bargaining session and being shocked. So I guess I must have heard somehow from people who had been before that I should go expecting a somewhat abrasive sort of session. I don't think they got to me quite to the extent that they may have gotten to other people. After all, I am an intermediate generation to some of the people who were involved in the bargaining, as we just discussed earlier, and therefore probably went in with a somewhat different set of expectations or a different view of what constitutes reasonable behavior.
Were you somewhat more sympathetic to them, do you think?
Emotionally, quite probably so. I think I had probably less of a feeling that these people were just behaving in a wholly inappropriate way by even having a union, by calling the running of the university into question. Because after all, back in 1960, I'd been one of those assistant professors who didn't have the kind of institutional loyalties which had been expected and had some residue left over from that. So, saying, why do we do things this way here, and being told because that's the Wisconsin way, and saying, what kind of answer is that? And then, you know, staring with mutual shock and surprise at the guy I was talking to, each that the other could, you know, have that point of view.
Yeah.
Intellectually, I didn't go in with any sympathy because it was clear from the very beginning that there was going to be a very heavy student power component to this whole TAA thrust, and actually that had been something that we'd been dealing with for a couple of years already, and I had already decided that was, as far as I was concerned, the less of that, the better.
Oh.
And, indeed, that was a point of view where I felt different from most of my colleagues in the departments. I felt more or less from the beginning the TA's demands for various aspects of which I can, you know, loosely call student power is real and serious and a bad thing, and from the faculty point of view or departmental point of view, and most of my colleagues were accepting what they were told by TAs that this is not real. These are just bargaining points. At any event, if we got them, they wouldn't amount to anything. And also my colleagues mostly felt, well, talking to students is a good thing, and this amounts to talking to students, so why don't we have more of it?
Hmm. So you say that the math department on the whole felt that it did have good rapport with TAs?
Oh, the faculty thought they had, fantastic rapport with TAs. Yeah, that was
all of them, not just the younger ones and the more liberal ones, but
sure.
You say the majority of them.
Sure.
I've been young enough to have gone down south and
I've been lectured by all the whites down there about how much better they understood blacks than people from up north.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to recognize the same overtones in the conversations with my colleagues. No longer am quite so sure now that as a 21-year-old northerner I understood blacks than the white southerners I was then talking to, but nonetheless, all the faculty around here was saying, get along fine with my TAs.
So this didn't cause any great rifts between TAs and faculty members in the math department?
Well, of course, as events wound along, it became harder for faculty to feel fully satisfied with this proposition that their rapport was an FT, because in the morning they'd be up on the ninth floor drinking coffee and experiencing nifty rapport, and then, you know, bad news would come back in the afternoon. You know, it's TAs, bargaining is going badly. TAs want to bring Jim Marchetti up here to harangue the troops.
Did they?
Yeah, he came up once. It was a very well publicized event. In math department terms, that is, for 2 weeks beforehand, we had notes all over, the Big M is coming. At that time, we didn't know who the Big M was. And so they must have had a, faculty members must have realized that all these pieces weren't adding up.
But there wasn't any, for instance, threats if you stay in the TAA, why you're out of a job or anything like that.
Give several different answers to that question. I certainly am not actually aware of any such threats. I never really heard of one. There are three or four faculty members whose attitudes, I have heard made statements about, well, it seems to me a terrible waste of time for TAs to be spending their time on this kind of stuff. They're here to learn mathematics. And, you know, number one, I can well imagine a TA hearing that as a covert threat, at least if that TA was also this guy's thesis student. Mm-hmm. And number two, in those particular cases, I wouldn't be shocked to discover that the guy had put his statement in a yet stronger form than I had given it on some occasion when I wasn't present. I think the number of people who felt that way wouldn't have amounted to more than five faculty members out of the whole department.
So there were no wildly emotional sessions there. When faculty confronted TAs or...
Nothing like what the English department was going through at that period.
The German department seems to have had
some...
not necessarily out of lack of sympathy, but I think the faculty were feeling betrayed by the TAs.
Right. Well, by the time we got to confronting a strike, by that stage, that was a component in the minds of many faculty members, but it wasn't the component. You know, the news that there was such a thing as a TAA did not engender that feeling in very many math department.
Do you want to describe Marchetti's visit here?
I don't have any recollection other than being in the room and saying, "Ah, there's Jim Marchetti." Uh-huh. Let's see. If I search around, yes, he gave some kind of statement about why a TAA, and he didn't convince me that, this included a rationale why TAA is involved in student power type issues. I was definitely not convinced, and in fact didn't think he had dealt with those problems really head on at all. And that's all I remember.
Did you know the four TA stewards from math were Ellis, Bowman, Tom Hay, Rick Ansel, and Don Corum? Do you remember any of them? Did you know them?
Yeah, I remember to greater or lesser extents Bowman and Hay and Ansel. Ansel actually is just getting a PhD here this
year.
That's
right. I guess I knew he was still here.
After the strike and a couple of years after that, he went elsewhere. And I forget what he did, but then he came back. I wasn't conscious of any of those guys as being involved with TAA until the strike. I don't know what their involvement was before the strike.
But nothing, they didn't make an impression upon you in the way they behaved or anything like that.
Not before the strike. No.
Well, do you want to talk about the strike?
None of those.
Did you observe it, by the way? I mean, did you cross the picket lines?
Oh, yeah. Very vivid period. There's nothing particularly significant about the strike which is particularly involved with these people. So perhaps if we're trying to do this thing chronologically, we should go back and work our way up to the strike. We had TA getting recognized, and of course, our rationale for the existence of TAA was the Shabazz bill, and we have perhaps some more reason than others to accept that rationale. as being the precipitating factor. I mean, it obviously did not create the whole, create TAA.
Yeah, it's been mentioned often as the precipitating.
It did, and I don't suppose we'll ever know whether all the things which provided the real fuel for TAA would have ever crystallized out into a TAA if it hadn't been for that bill, or whether they wouldn't have. It's quite possible they wouldn't have. Certainly, Hasluck had been, there had been a TAA before this, Hasluck had been active in it before that. People occasionally, you know, would even go along to a meeting just out of a sort of interest because he was involved. And
people, you mean?
Faculty types, yeah. Or ask him about it, you know, how's the old union coming? And our impression was that the union was really nowhere up until that moment. And within, you know, a matter of not many weeks after that, it was a pretty big muscular operation. And, so that, and we had had somewhat more of a picture than most faculty of what was going on with the union. In a very vague sense, we certainly didn't know, you know, what union policy was on this or that issue. But you know, the degree to which there was or wasn't a union, we had some sense of. And it seemed to us that there was a real jump just at that moment. So we had TAA being recognized. I'm sure there are people on the faculty in the math departments who felt that a union is has no place on campus, or at least a union of mathematicians, involving mathematicians, has no place on campus at that moment, and who continue to feel it to this day. And again, I think this would be a fairly small minority of the departments. From, I don't know, 5% to 25%, and perhaps depending on those people who really feel that it's just plain wrong and there's an end on it, to people who feel this really is uncongenial. I can, perhaps it's the way it has to be, but I wish it didn't have to be that way. This, in terms of the existence of any kind of union, if we take the people who somehow wish that we didn't have a TAA, as we do have it, actually, I think if the word were to come out somehow the TAA had disappeared tomorrow, probably 85 to 90% of the math department faculty would say, that's nice, with, you know, greater or lesser degrees of enthusiasm. But even those who would actually defend, you know, it's raison d'etre, who would say, yes, TAs ought to have it, would still be very glad, many of them, to hear that TAs had decided they could do without it. Because, you know, even though they approve of it in principle, occasionally they bump their noses on it in practice. Mm.
That's something we really we have to go into, is how they do, but go on.
Yeah. later on. So there was this minority who was interested, you know, upset by this decision to a greater or lesser degree, that we were going to have a represented union, a union representing TAs. And, the vast majority who said, my, that's, you know, that's kind of interesting as a topic for today's conversation, but initially didn't see it as much more than that. And then bargaining got geared up, and